Chris Ullman has had an amazing life. First, he was the world whistling champion. He won it 4 times. Second, he was basically the head of PR and communications for many successful, huge politicians, presidential candidates, governors, and advisor to several billionaires. He's in, most notably, he worked for 18 years for David Rubenstein, who runs the Carlyle Group. He's been on this podcast quite a few times. And Chris just wrote a book, 4 Billionaires and a Parking Attendant. Lessons he's learned from all these different billionaires and politicians, and lessons he also learned from a parking attendant. But prior to that, he also wrote a book called Find Your Whistle, and it's his adventures on the way to being the world whistling champion. So we talk about both topics. It's part one and part two. The first part is basically, how do you be the best in the world at what you love doing? Whistling is not easy, and being the world champion at any art form is not easy. We talk about that. Then part two, we talk about 4 billionaires and a parking attendant, and the stories are incredible. At the end of part two, Chris also whistles for us. So let's start off with becoming the world champion at the thing you love doing. That's part one coming up. And then part two will be the next podcast, and it'll be all about lessons he learned from the billionaires and a parking attendant.
This isn't your average business podcast, and he's not your average host. This is the James Altucher Show.
So Chris, we can really almost do 2 podcasts with you. One is you were the world whistling champion several times, many times, which is an amazing thing in and of itself. And I want to talk about that. Also, you have a book that just came out, 4 Billionaires and a Parking Attendant. And you've worked with all these billionaires and gotten great life advice or life learnings from them. And also a parking attendant in the parking lot where you often parked. So yeah. Both of these books are amazing, and you've had an amazing life still having it. I honestly don't know where to start. So let's start with whistling. You started whistling at the age of 5. How does someone even become world whistling champion?
Well, James, thanks for having me, first of all. It's a real honor to be on your show. And so my father was a good whistler. And, you know, so much of it comes down to, can you whistle? And it's very binary. I've met a lot of people in my life who just cannot whistle. They go, nothing comes out versus that coming out. And so I'm able to whistle. And then, you know, since I do public relations for a living, I think in talking points. I'm able to whistle. I love to practice. I'm competitive. I'm good at arranging music for my instrument, the whistle. I'm a bit of a showman. I found the International Whistling Competition back in, 1993. Competed 9 times, won it 4 times, came in 2nd a few times. And it was a great run. And I don't compete anymore. I just perform. And I also whistle happy birthday 650 times a year for people, which is what I call my birthday a whistling ministry.
Why do you whistle happy birthday to people?
I want to honor their lives. And you know, what's so interesting about happy birthday is usually you sing it for your family or your colleagues if you're in an office. But I actually get to insert myself into the lives of 650 people and bring them these like little packets of joy. Like I just did 3, literally like 5 minutes ago, I whistled happy birthday 3 times and I recorded on my iPhone a little voice memo and I just texted to them. And people write back these amazing notes. They say, you made my day. My day wouldn't be complete if I didn't have a whistlegram from you. And so it warms my heart. And, you know, I'm just convinced that we need to like stop thinking about ourselves and think about other people. You know, if every day I have to be nice to someone through whistling, no, it's good. It keeps me humble.
And, you know, as you describe in the book, your kind of domination of the whistling world, if you want to call it that, and you know, it takes a lot of practice. You have a huge repertoire of songs you could whistle. You obviously have the talent and the skill, but you had to do work at the skill. I'm curious, the process of becoming a whistling champion, it's really a champion at anything, but for you, whistling, the process of becoming a whistling champion, world whistling champion, do you think that helped you career-wise? And I'm asking in two different directions. One is because everyone's impressed that you're the best in the world at something. And number two, because of the discipline it took to become and the way of thinking it takes to become the best in the world at something.
Yeah, you know, that process of like coming up with this idea saying, wow, I'm a pretty good whistler. Maybe I could be the best one day. So like it actually sets you on a journey. So, I mean, first it's a mindset. You have an objective. And then day in and day out, you have to figure out, how do I get there? You know, what are my strengths? What are my weaknesses? And this applies, as you just said, you could be a violinist, a trombonist, or a hedge fund manager like you. And so you have to think, you know, what is it going to take to get there? And with whistling, it is, for me at least, it was a combination of making sure I had a really wide range. In my peak form, I had over a 3-octave range, which is a pretty wide range. And then the capacity to arrange music for your instrument. So I can listen to, you know, a Beethoven symphony and have to figure out, you know, a lot of notes going on there. I have to figure out how to catch the tune or the main theme. So I was very good at that. And, you know, just being relentless. And, you know, my new book, Four Billionaires and a Parking Attendant, there's all these people in there, they are just relentless. They set their sights on something and just go, go, go. And like I did this crazy thing in 1996. I was training for the training. It really, you really do for the international competition.
And of course, it's training. I'm just curious. Why did you almost seem a little ashamed when you said the word training?
Because people, you know, for years, people have said to me, "Do you practice?" And I used to be insulted, and I would say, "What do you mean, do I practice? How can you be good at anything if you don't practice?" But I realized that people think whistling is just a silly little thing, and why would you have to practice to be good at it? So I've actually become a little insecure about it. So I'm glad you picked up on that.
I want to ask you about that, like because many areas of life can seem frivolous, right? So let's say some people think whistling is that way. That's the reaction you got from some people. But also taking a, you know, inflated ball and throwing it through a net as many times as possible in a 60-minute period, that could be considered frivolous too. And yet, you know, some people make $80 million a year doing it. So I always wonder about this. Like, yes, some recreational activities are considered frivolous and some are considered worthy of $80 million a year. And you know, the NBA has $10 billion in revenues a year. So money has sort of like set the bar on frivolity. And yet there's nothing to some, whistling is musical, it's creative, it's very difficult. There's nothing that makes whistling more frivolous than basketball, other than the fact that basketball is a $10 billion industry. So we take it a little more seriously somehow. I'm just curious if there's anything.
Yeah. And those are very good points. What's happened with the challenge with whistling, which is why people kind of put it in the frivolous category or the novelty category, is that there is not a lot of music written for whistler. Now that may sound strange, but it helps legitimize an instrument. I mean, if you want to, if you go to the classical music catalog, there's tons of music for violin and trumpet and cello, piano, but you'll find almost nothing for whistler. So for example, I reached out, this is years ago, to 50 orchestras and said, "I can whistle Mozart's oboe concerto. Can I perform with you?" And two of them said yes, but 48 of them completely ignored me. And it's because they're used to hearing the Andy Griffith theme song or men catcalling women. And so there's been this group of us who've tried to legitimize whistling and take it from novelty to art. And with some success, I mean, I've whistled with 12 symphony orchestras, and I had other whistlers. There's this guy in the Netherlands named Geert Chartreux, who's arguably the best whistler today. I mean, he's whistled with many orchestras. So there's a small, like, little contingent of us who are taking it to the next level, but we don't have all that infrastructure. We don't have the music written for us. There aren't whistling schools. So we kind of train on our own. And you'll actually find that most whistlers are good singers because they actually learned how to make music by singing. And then that is very transferable to whistling.
That's interesting. I wouldn't think it was, because I feel like you could have a sense, of, what's it called when you have perfect pitch?
Perfect pitch, like
It's easier to have correct pitch with whistling, I would think, than singing, because the vocal cords connection to the brain, it seems like, is not as fast.
No. If you have perfect pitch, you can hum a note, you could sing a note, you could whistle a note. It really has, or you could get a trombone and play it, if you know how to play a trombone, and hear, you know, get to the right note. So I don't have perfect pitch. I have what I call a kind of perfect relative pitch. Like, once I'm in the right key, I can stay in the right key. But there are people who you can say to them, hum an A flat, and boom, they can just hum it in the absence of any reference point.
So again, people ask if you train. Going back to that, like, people ask if you train. Yeah. And of course you train quite a bit. Like, what was and by the way, we're going to get to the four billionaires and a parking attendant. That's the main. But I am just fascinated by excellence, because it's very, very difficult to be the best in the world at anything. And what was your training regimen like on a daily basis?
So I usually whistle around 2 hours a day. And then I would do crazy things, like get in my car, and I drove to Graceland once for a week and whistled for 6 hours every day for seven straight days. And the reason is that, you know, A, you want to practice your music, but B, and perhaps more importantly, you have to get your lips in shape. You may be familiar with the French word called embouchure, and it actually has to do with the shape of and the conditioning of your lips to play a wind instrument. It could be a trumpet, a clarinet, or any wind instrument. It's the same thing with whistling, is that a pucker is not a natural position for your lips. So when you take this kind of complex musculature and stick your lips out into this very precise shape, and then try to sustain that for minutes on end, I whistled Mozart's Oboe Concerto. It's 22 minutes long. If your lips are not in tip-top shape, they will get tired quickly, and then you will lose the perfect positioning, that embouchure, to be able to sustain the note. So that's why conditioning is so important. And then practicing your actual song. Like right now, I'm working on Hummel's Trumpet Concerto. I'm performing it with the Alexandria Symphony Orchestra later this year. So I know the piece well, but I have to get my lips in good shape. And so it's going to be real exciting to perform classical music with an orchestra. And when I perform with the National Symphony, I mean, this is a 70-piece orchestra at the U.S. Capitol in front of 65,000 people, and you are immersed in sound. It's probably one of the most exquisite experiences of my life, to have an orchestra enveloping me with sound, and then 65,000 people in front of me, and then the U.S. Capitol lit up behind them. Nothing will ever touch that in terms of this confluence of cool things.
Do they have a part written where you get to solo whistle for a few moments?
Yep. Yeah, so in that particular song, it's a song called On the Mall, which was written in the 1920s, and it's a march. And so and it's written for Whistler. It's one of the few pieces out there actually written for Whistler. And so I performed it. And the really cool part was that at the end of the concert, they brought me back and I taught the audience the song. And then we performed it again. And I conducted this mass a whistling group of 65,000 people. And that was cool. And it's a really catchy tune. And people loved it.
I mean, that's amazing. Like, on the one hand, we talked a little while ago about, you know, how you felt insecure about, you know, is whistling worthy, a worthy endeavor to spend thousands of hours on and compete in? And yet, look at this experience it created for you. Like, let's say one thing life, you know, everybody debates, what is life about? Oh, be a good person, be a happy person, do this, be a successful person, whatever. But maybe life is about creating these amazing experiences. And how many people, I can count on one hand, maybe people who have had an experience at that level of amazing.
Yeah, well, I count my blessings every day. I never could have predicted or anticipated what whistling has allowed me to do. I mean, I've whistled in the Oval Office for the president. I whistled at Major League Baseball and basketball stadiums, the national anthem. I even whistled, this is totally freaky, at the top of the Washington Monument on the outside, 555 feet in the air. And then whistling happy birthday for people, done TED Talks. It has brought me more joy than ever imaginable. And which is why I count my blessings every day that this has happened. I've worked hard and I've made a point of getting good, but you know, life is strange and you never know when crazy things are going to happen. So you've got to kind of revel in the moment. You know, my life philosophy is that, you know, it's not the destination, it's the trip. You know, that's not, you know, other people think that too, but that is, I've embraced this philosophy since I was like 13 years old. And that's why you must kind of revel in the moment. I mean, there's always an eye towards the future, but the moment is critical.
Well, you know, it's an interesting thing. I go back and forth on what you just said. It's all about the journey and not the destination, because a lot of it is actually about the destination. Like, you had a goal, which was to win the grand competition for whistling. I feel that the destination, A, it sets the path of the journey. So it defines, the destination defines what you do on the journey. Like, if you're going on a quest for the Holy Grail, okay, you've got to get out, the knights of King Arthur's court had to get on their horses and travel the world and seek out information about the Holy Grail. It created the journey. And when you won the competition, that was probably, you probably felt better that moment than in any given day training for the competition.
Well, you're totally right. And, you know, they are opposite sides of the same coin, arguably, is that having, you know, and a big part of the new book is about purpose, you know, having a destination you're going to, because I think having purpose gives us, you know, something to strive for. So I agree with all of that, you know, and having worked for some of the most successful people, you know, in business and politics, they all have purpose and an objective. All right. So I agree with that. But the challenge is when today slips away because you're so focused on tomorrow. And so in a perfect world, you have purpose. You know, yes, I want to graduate from college with a good GPA. That's a great purpose to have. But there are, you know, there are 1,000 school days between today and that day. What are those 1,000 days going to be like? But, you know, until they hand you that diploma. And if, you know, if you're fixated on, you know, when I pay off my mortgage, then I'll be happy. Or when I graduate, I'll be happy. Or when I retire, then I'll be happy, which can dominate the way people think. You know, that's dangerous. So they're not mutually exclusive.
Like, if you had never won, let's say you had always come in second and third and you never took first at the competition for whistling, would you have written the book on whistling that you wrote? So the book I have here is Find Your Whistle.
Yeah, you know, probably not. Mm-hmm. So,
even though you would have been the second best whistler on the planet, number two sucks.
Well, there is a fixation in our culture, and maybe it's the human condition, for the best. And so I do appreciate that. And, you know, I am the kind of person that even if it had not been, the pinnacle of whistling, that I would find purpose, have that objective, but then revel in every moment. I mean, yesterday I met a security guard in an office building who helped me, figure out the elevator. I had a little fob and all that, couldn't figure it out. And now I know her name. She has a beautiful smile. And she said, I look forward to seeing you tomorrow. And it would have been so easy to view that as just this fleeting transaction of I need to get in the elevator versus a human with a name, with a beautiful smile, who actually is looking forward to seeing me tomorrow. That matters. And arguably, the accumulation of those types of moments matter even more than, these bogeys that you're shooting for. I mean, just yesterday, my 17-year-old daughter said, Dad, she's a little shy. And she said, I want to be more like you and just talk to strangers. She said, you can learn a lot. I see you talk to strangers all the time. You learn so much. I say, yeah, I mean, we're not going to be best buddies necessarily, but you just never know. And, that those things matter. You can argue how much they matter, but I think they matter a huge amount.
You are a trained communicator. This is what you've done for billionaires for decades, is you've been their right-hand man when it comes to communicating and getting their word out there and their message out there and their goals out there. And it's been your job to talk to strangers and billionaires and presidents and so on. And again, we'll get to that in a second. One more question I have, and again, this is related to the frivolous aspect, because I am fascinated by that pause that you had when you were training, but before you won. Was there any point where you felt like you had to justify to your wife or your family or your friends or colleagues or work colleagues that why you're spending hours a day doing this? Did you feel bad at any point during that process because, hey, I should be making $1 billion and not whistling?
Well, thankfully I was single at the time because I could barely tolerate listening to that much whistling. And when I did that Graceland pilgrimage, the 6 hours a day, I was single and alone in the car. Actually, my wife doesn't even let me whistle around the house very much. She thinks it's fairly annoying. So if I were married with children, and then I discovered this competition, I don't know if it would have worked out. So it was kind of providential that I was single when it happened.
What about though, your friends? Like for instance, in my 20s, I left graduate school in computer science because I wanted to be a writer. I was writing all the time. And like any form of communication, it takes a lot of years actually to be a good writer. And my friends and parents thought I was completely insane. Like they really thought I was mentally ill for leaving one of the best graduate schools in computer science where my career was set if I got a PhD there, as opposed to doing something completely, who knows? Most people don't succeed at writing, and I was not a good writer at the time. So I had a healthy dose of Dunning-Kruger bias, so I thought I was good, but I certainly wasn't good. So I had to constantly question myself and answer their questions about why I was doing what I was doing.
So I'm glad you brought up writing as this, and I'm going to juxtapose that with the whistling. See, there are tons of people who call themselves writers, and most people are used to reading things. It can be the newspaper or books or billboards. All right. So if someone like you says, I'm going to be a writer, a lot of people are going to say, oh, you know how hard it is to be a writer. Why would you bother with that? Now, with whistling, so I say to people, hey, there's a whistling competition. I'm going to try that. People are like, whistling? That's really freaky. That sounds cool. Let's hear it. So there are just so few of them that people are kind of drawn to it and view it as novelty versus the writing, which is kind of a dime a dozen. That doesn't mean you're not a good writer. But a lot of people say, I'm going to go be a writer, or I'm going to go to Hollywood and make my fortune. But very few people say, I'm going to be a champion whistler. So people are more fascinated by it than poo-pooing it.
Yeah, I agree. And I think people don't realize how difficult a skill it is to write, for instance. So everybody with a word processor now becomes a writer. Oh, you posted an article on Medium that got 20 likes. Now you're a writer. And people don't understand that just like in anything, most things are bad. So most written material is not good writing. I always look for great, great writers to inspire my own writing. And it's very, very hard for me. Like, it's thousands of books I have to look at for every one that I find that, oh, this is going to inspire me to write. And, wow. And this is over 30 years of writing almost every day now, but, I would imagine you're right with whistling. Like when you told me, oh, you're a world champion whistler, I was fascinated. If someone said to me, oh, I'm a world champion writer, all right. But
that's exactly it. Now, interestingly, whistling is very binary in terms of who likes it and who doesn't. So I was in an elevator once with Newt Gingrich when he was the Speaker of the House, and my then boss, who's John Kasich, who was governor of Ohio and ran for president. And Kasich says, Newt, you got to hear Chris whistle. It's amazing. Newt wouldn't even look at me. He completely ignored Kasich. Then Kasich tries again. He's been on the Tonight Show. He's been on the Today Show. You got to hear him whistle. Nothing. So there are some people who just think it's so freaky they want nothing to do with it. And then other people, you'll say to them, hey, I'm a whistler. And they're like, their eyes light up. And this is what happened with the National Symphony. I met one of the conductors, and a friend of mine said, hey, Chris is a champion whistler. And she's like, whistle for me. So I whistle a song. And then she's like, hey, you want to perform with the National Symphony Orchestra? Said, yeah, let's do it. So it's very binary there too.
The lesson really that I take from this is that excellence opens doors, and it opens unusual doors in many ways. Like, so I'm very much into chess. I'm a competitive chess player. I'm not like the best in the world, but I'm doing something unusual, which is that after a 25-year period where I did not play in tournaments, so I'm a ranked chess master from the 90s, then I stopped playing for 25 years in order to have a career.
Wow.
And now I'm on a quest to be as strong as I was in the 90s. And just going on this quest has opened so many doors and adventures for me. Like, I was invited to go to Amsterdam next week to just watch this tournament with the organizer and of among the very great players are playing. And I can imagine for you being the best in the world at something, excellence opens doors, and it's worth it to achieve excellence in something, regardless of whether other people consider, you know, its status in the hierarchy. Now, of course, if you were the best basketball player ever, that also has a significant monetary gain. That's the door it opens. But excellence in anything has benefits.
I think it's very well put. You know, whistling doesn't pay well, so I've always had a day job. But that in itself has made my whistling career even more interesting. You know, so here I am. I'm at the Carlyle Group, you know, this big global private equity firm. My phone rings. It's the founder of the firm, David Rubenstein. He says, come to my office. I walk down the hall, and there is Ted Leonsis, who is the owner of the Wizards and the Caps, or whatever they're called these days, the hockey team.
By the way, he's been on the podcast.
Good. He's an interesting guy. I've heard him speak. So David says, whistle for Ted. Like, okay. And like a kind of a pet monkey. It's like, hey, you, come over here and whistle. And so I whistle. And then Ted says, hey, do you want to whistle national anthem at a Wizards game? So you are right. He heard it. He liked it. And that opened a door. And that's why I just count my blessings. Like, all these crazy things that have happened. They continue to happen. You know, I get to perform, go on TV, go on podcasts, and and so it's been great.
Last question about it. Like, when you, so at one point you had won the championship four times, and you stopped for a while, and then 5 years later you went back to try to win again. was it, and I'm asking this almost selfishly, but did you, as you age and as you get a little rusty, do the training techniques change through time so other whistlers have more sophisticated training techniques of who start now? Or does aging result in some decline in ability? Like, what did you experience when you tried to come back to it?
So I understand why you're asking this question as you seek to regain your chess status. And
yes.
So what I realized then and now too is that there is an accumulation of ability. It could be chess ability, it could be whistling ability, that it there's a certain baseline you achieve because you're doing something all the time. And then you may step it up if you have a competition or a performance, but your baseline is already high. When you take a break, your baseline falls so low that to get back up just takes a lot more than you would think. It's less about age, I believe, and more about time. So the key is putting the time in. So, if the National Symphony called me tomorrow and said, we want you to do some like really big concert in 6 months, I could get back into like tip-top form if I whistled 2 hours a day for 6 months. It would be hard because I've got a busy consulting business. I've got books and I've got children. I like to ride my bicycle. So, and I got to keep my wife happy. So it would be a challenge to jam it in there, but that's what it would take. And I suspect it's similar to you. You probably have to go back and just play. You have to, it's like, if I want to be a good whistler, I have to whistle all the time to get the lips in shape. And I assume you have to keep playing and playing and studying the books and the moves. And
for some things, and maybe music is not one of these things, or maybe composing music is, but not playing music. I don't know. But like, as you age, you're not as sharp, like your thoughts aren't as fast and your memory is not as good, but your ability to do pattern recognition and intuition goes up. So performing music, maybe you're able to kind of like, oh, I'm going to add this bluesy sound to this classical piece. And like, you're able to kind of assimilate other things and put them together in interesting ways, which you wouldn't be able to do maybe when you were younger. But some professions benefit from age. So like peak age for a historian is actually 69 years old, whereas peak age for a mathematician is 25 years old, where you would require more sharpness and more memory and, wow, and so on. Whereas a historian can say, oh, this event from Afghanistan reminds me of this one battle in World War II. So you have this huge wealth of knowledge and an ability to kind of like put them together in interesting ways that you didn't have when you were younger. And that's something that sort of happens in your 40s and 50s and keeps growing. So it's interesting.
I love that point. And I love the point about adding the little bluesy thing, because I am doing that with this trumpet piece. I'm improvising in a few sections. I haven't told the conductor yet. I'm hoping he will be open to it. To say, listen, the key with great music and great writing, you could argue, is you have to make it your own. There's no, if it's cookie cutter, people are going to say, all right, I've heard that before. I want to make it distinctive. Like, for example, I listened to, so Vladimir Ashkenazy is one of the great pianists of our day, and he's a conductor now, and then his son is a clarinetist. And I listened to his son play Mozart's clarinet concerto the other day, and it was he embraced that piece like I've never seen before. All these little curls and twists and things that he added to it that I'd never heard, that I thought were appropriate, but so unique, and he made it his. So, and that's the way to do it, I think. So I'm going to try to do that with this trumpet piece to really make it mine. If anyone in the audience knows the piece, they're going to say, well, I've never heard it done that way before, but still think it's appropriate and enjoyable.
That's such an important point, in a variety of ways, to make something yours. So like, I think like this is very important, by the way, for employees at a job. Like if you work at a company, there's usually a history, a culture of the product of, whether is this a luxury product? Is this a kids product? Is it a, you know, like I used to work at HBO very briefly, and HBO, you could tell if a show is HBO or if a show is ABC, like there's a difference. And I feel when employees really are able to say, this is our product, as opposed to this is my company's product. Like when they really kind of feel the philosophy and culture and make it their own, that philosophy, then they succeed as employees. Like Carlyle Group is a very different kind of private equity group than Blackstone. And I'm sure you feel the nuances. What makes Carlyle and David Rubenstein different from, for better or for worse, Steve Schwarzman and Blackstone?
Exactly. When I tell people about, when I either teach writing to young people or kind of developing your own brand in the marketplace, I'm all about saying, you know, understand you as a product, understand your craft as a writer, but make it your own and be distinctive about it. You know, not just to, you know, be a peacock that's all flash.
Right.
But to do it with purpose so that the distinctions add value in some way. You know, one of the big distinctions with Carlyle was that we said people like working with us more because we're not your typical sharp-elbowed New Yorker. Now, Blackstone people might have bristled at that, but we thought it was true, and that was the feedback we got. Because in the end, they have buckets of money, so do we. They have buckets of MBAs from Wharton, Stanford, and HBS, so did we. So like you had to have a differentiator, and we thought it was our culture of actually being nice to each other. Now, that has changed a lot since I left. Not for the better, but I think it's on the mend now that they have a new CEO. But that's a whole nother subject.
One thing I was going to ask you and maybe even suggest to you, so take it for what it's worth. You should make TikTok videos doing pop culture covers of whistling of like every, like do Hotel California whistling, do a cover of some great rap song whistling. I bet you that would, you would get like millions of, not that you are interested in this, but I get you like millions of views and followers and so on. Like I would listen to, I would subscribe to an Instagram channel that was all whistling covers of like my favorite songs.
You know what? What's fascinating about what you just said is, you know, it's all about time allocation. And, you know, even, I don't know how much money you made on your book, but making money on a book is difficult. You know, unless you're Walter Isaacson writing about Elon Musk. So I'm always weighing, you know, I get paid well as a consultant. So every hour I spend consulting for corporate America, I make tons of money. Every hour I spend working on my next book, I don't make a lot of money. But I get great satisfaction out of creating the whistling book, creating this new book about the billionaires and the parking attendant. And money is less important to me now than 60 years old and financially secure. I try for a balance, but to get specifically to your point about like TikTok and social media is that I tend to avoid social media because it is a rabbit hole. Because people say to me, how do you have time to write a book? And I say, well, I don't sleep that much. I don't watch TV and I don't do social media, which actually frees up a lot of time.
Yeah.
And I don't mean to be judgmental. If social media is your thing, that's fine. But the odds are if you spend a lot of time doing that, you're probably not going to write a book. But if that's not your thing, then hey, that's cool.
That was more selfish request because I want to listen to some rap song being whistled. So I would just love to hear stuff like that. Wow. I really was fascinated. I'm always fascinated in what it takes to become the best in the world at something you love, or even just to excel at something you love, which is very, very difficult. But obviously, it's an incredible story. If you want to hear Chris whistle, stay tuned because in part two, which covers his latest book, Four Billionaires and a Parking Attendant, first off, you should pre-order the book or order the book on Amazon. Second, part two is amazing. Stay tuned for it. And at the end, he whistles.